Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, drama in the Premier League as the Toffees down Chelsea. With Terry and his teammates not looking so comfortable on top of the table, the pod asks, did Vanessa leave the cutlery out? And with their inspirational skipper now losing his edge, we're flying off with the family help. And no, I'm not talking about my skiing trip. Elsewhere, there's EastEnders drama. Can Gianfranco Zola stave off Hammergeddon? While across town, has Harry's luck run out at Spurs? There's Paul Doyle on Ligue 1, Sid Lowe on whether Guardiola really told the Gunners, I want your Cesc, posts, and we preview this weekend's fifth round FA Cup action, including Palace, Villa and Portsmouth, insolvent like a glue sliffer's nose, facing neighbours Southampton in what could be their last ever game. All of that in Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. And especially to Paul Doyle.
Oi.
Yeah, indeed so, Paul. Oi to you too. And Barry Glendenning.
Hammergeddon ready for a good podcast today.
Oh, very, very nice. And you'll be churning out similar nuggets in the Fiver, perhaps, later today.
Hopefully.
Yeah, nice one. And John Ashdown.
Hello. I've got no novelty greeting, so I'll just say hello.
All right, then. How are you doing on the alphabet? Everyone always says, oh, I can't believe you had John Ashdown on the alphabet.
I'm really sorry, but there's lockdown on it at the moment.
Really?
Yeah. There's no.
What letter
no
are you
movement.
Stuck on?
Because I know stuck on G. And despite Barry's offers to get us moving again.
Yeah. Now, there's been all sorts of midweek games since last we spoke. And, crikey, Everton, who looked abject at the weekend at Anfield, suddenly, without indeed their midfield linchpin, Marouane Fellaini, become a top team and do over Chelsea. How did this happen? Paul Doyle, Chelsea's weakness suddenly been exposed?
I believe so. I didn't see the game.
No.
But I did see the Everton-Chelsea game at Stamford Bridge a couple of months ago.
Well, that's close enough, isn't it? You saw
well,
the goals, though,
I saw the goals from last night, good. And it did suggest that Everton exploited a vulnerability in the air, Louis Saha in particular, which is exactly what they had done at Stamford Bridge a few months ago. So any suggestion that John Terry may have been sidetracked by recent disclosures about his private life would seem awry, because, as I say, he was similarly vulnerable just a few months ago to the same player.
Chelsea, of course, with a bit of a woeful record away from home, just one win in seven. Ashley Cole about the only Chelsea player who continues to get points on the road, of course. Bit of a motoring offence, okay, that one. But there you go. Chuck Schick is at hand, posting in with his analysis of what went wrong at Goodison Park. He says, one, Terry. Two, Ancelotti's lineup was suspect. Joe Cole, Zirkov and Malouda. I don't think that makes sense. Two out of three, maybe. And three, Carlo also seems to be struggling with Anelka in this altered formation. Gus managed it, but Nick looks a little lost. Interesting that the results really picked up for Chelsea when Ancelotti went with 4-3-3 or 4-3-2-1, etc., etc. But when Drogba's returned, despite his goals and influences, the performances have dropped off. Anelka does seem to be a little bit out of sorts since Didier returned.
Well, yes, when Didier Drogba was away at the African Cup of Nations, Nick Anelka became top banana very much, and he was playing up front and doing very well. And now that Drogba's back, Anelka's been shunted out to the wing again, where he's not playing. Well, it's not that he's playing badly, but he's just not as effective, I think. And you can't really leave Didier Drogba out of the Chelsea team, because he's arguably the best player in the Premier League. So the question is, how do you solve a problem like Nicolas Anelka?
Right, okay. And how did he go from being top banana to frittering away chances? That would be the other question. How's your hat, Paul Doyle? Because Raphael Honigstein said it was the funniest thing about the... No, he said it was the nicest thing about the Chelsea press conference he was at last weekend.
Well, it is a very elegant hat. He's right.
Okay, excellent. Well, you want to describe it?
No.
All right, okay. Right, okay. John Terry, he's gone off to Dubai. To patch things up with Mrs. Terry. Our thanks to Isha Hammer, who posted in with a full explanation of where it was. You remember I raised the issue of where John Terry, what were the circumstances vis-a-vis the disabled parking incident, and it was as bad as it sounded, basically. There were plenty of other options for him. Anyway, any thoughts on John Terry being given the weekend off?
Well, I read in our own website this morning that apparently Terry had a serious look on his face as he was escorted to the plane at London Heathrow Airport shortly after 8:30 a.m. He was wearing blue jeans and a white hooded top, so It's good to see we're covering the big news, the big important right. news of the day.
Excellent. Well,
what John Terry is wearing when he goes on a plane to see his family.
Right. Now, back in the Premier League in the meantime, just 1 point now between Chelsea and Man United, who failed to take advantage of the Blues' defeat. Although they did manage to get a point even with 10 men, which is impressive, no?
Well, is it impressive these days? Well, on the site today, Jonathan Wilson himself has been asking the question, are teams getting better at playing with 10 men against 11? And the stats show that the way that the
game's
going...
Is that why Capello picks Emil Heskey?
No, it's all about systems and that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think Villa have a tendency, I think, to be slightly unadventurous, perhaps, against some of the big sides. And I think they struggled really to break them down. I think James Milner had one sort of chance in the second half. But it wasn't, it was another one. It was quite a stodgy night of football, really.
Yeah. You were saying on Monday, if memory serves, Barry, that was one of the big problems with Villa is that it might have been Raphael Honigstein, actually.
No, well, I think it was me, and I got a hammering on it from a couple of, I suspect, Villa supporters on the comment section of the blog. But I just think Villa aren't very adventurous, and that if they have notions about finishing fourth, they shouldn't be so cautious. They should go and try and win games. Mm. If the height of their ambition is getting a point at White Hart Lane, then why bother even trying to qualify for the Champions League? And last night it seemed like they didn't really know what to do. Once United had gone down to 10 men, they didn't know how to capitalise on it. And as far as I know, I've only seen highlights of the game, so I can't comment, you know, on having viewed the whole thing, that they were, again, overcautious.
And, of course, United had gone down to 10 men with the sending off of Nani. And he'll be out for three games now, one of the most informed players.
He'll miss the Carling Cup final, I think.
Against Villa, yeah.
It was a shocking challenge, though.
It was a bit.
Yeah, it was a nasty one.
Well, I mean, the fact that even Ferguson didn't try to defend it or say that he shouldn't have been sent off sort of speaks volumes about it.
Well, there you go. They move to within a point of Chelsea. Arsenal are now just 6 points behind. Texan posts in, pointing out that... in our treatment of Arsenal's season so far, the pod has been contradicting, flip-flopping and indulging in reactionary comment. Basically, we change every time they get a win there.
So what, we're being criticised for reacting to Arsenal's latest results?
Well, perhaps what we're being criticised...
On a twice-weekly football
show. Well, yeah, we're perhaps overreacting. Flip-flopping faster than Didier chasing an errant referee, if you will. But that's the question. Does being slightly less rubbish than struggling Liverpool on a Wednesday night and capturing a 1-0 win. Does that represent another shift in the title chance paradigm?
Well, it was a good win, but...
Was it?
Well, they won. After, on the back of two consecutive defeats, it was an important win.
Right.
It was an awful game, terrible, terrible game.
The result was all the more significant because, of course, United and Chelsea also dropped points, so they did close the gap, and everyone is now pointing to Arsenal's run-in because while they've struggled against the big teams so far this season and have been beaten home and away by Chelsea and United, they don't have to play those guys again. They've got a fairly comfortable run in.
Yeah.
The easiest of any of the teams.
It is easy, but traditionally when you're trying to chase another team at the top of the table, you usually say when you've got a match against them that that's an advantage because that becomes a six-pointer.
But the teams above them have to play each other. At least one of them... at least one of Chelsea and United are going to drop points when they play each other, for example.
Indeed.
And again, Liverpool, from what I gather, basically went to play this against Arsenal the same way that Chelsea did and try and hit them on the break. The big difference being Liverpool didn't have Didier Drogba or Fernando Torres, they had David Ngo, which isn't the same thing.
Mowgli84 says, has Howard Webb ever refereed a big match well?
He must have done at some point, otherwise he wouldn't be the top banana ref. We've said top banana twice now. Twice too many. He wouldn't be the top referee in the country.
Right. Now goes pear-shaped on a regular basis. Yeah.
Recently, he has been very annoying, because he's been extremely lenient in most matches. He's taken this idea of letting the game flow far too extremely.
Right. Missing the Fabregas handball was quite an
omission.
It
wasn't omission. In the box, though, so it wouldn't have been a penalty.
I was.
That's a tricky one, because
There was a very tall player next to him.
If he was standing on the line, which he may well have had a heel on the edge of the area, then he is in the box.
Right.
So, but yeah, it was a shock. How did he miss it? I mean, he was standing there. He had a good...
He was standing there, but I think between him and Fabregas, or right next to Fabregas, was a very tall player. I'm not sure it might have been Diaby, yeah? And Fabregas is quite short, as he was demonstrating against Drogba on the weekend. So it's quite possible that he couldn't see Fabregas' upstretched arm. Beyond the head of Diaby.
What was Fabregas doing?
What was he doing with his arm up in the air in the first place? That's what his head's for, surely.
Don't know. Maybe he saw a scout from Barcelona in the crowd. I'm over here. My bag's in the locker room. We'll speak to Sid, actually, about that fresh, new and exciting rumour about Fabregas possibly returning to Catalonia later on. On the subject of transfers, though, Cable 1973 says, so Liverpool have beaten a host of quality teams, and Juventus, to sign Jovanovic. That's quite a coup. Excellent player. He's 28 years old and is playing for Standard Liège. Is he an excellent player?
From what I've seen of him, and that is mainly through Liège's European campaign this season and last, he did look excellent.
Right.
Predominantly left-sided player, very good dribbler, strong on the ball, excellent crosser, and he can also finish and get his fair share of goals too. So from the little I've seen of him, he does look like a fine acquisition, although the fact that he's hasn't done anything in his early 20s and mid-20s does raise question marks about him, I guess. But he could be just a late bloomer.
More Premier League to come a little bit later on. But, Paul, we'll just finish off with part one with the game that you actually saw. West Ham against Birmingham at Upton Park. Very interesting matches. Big win for under-pressure Gianfranco Zola.
Yeah, it was. And judging by the way that West Ham tackled the match, the players were intent on showing their support for them. They went into it and they really began in impressive fashion. But Birmingham, as is their wont, were quite compact and held them at bay. And West Ham started to get a bit jittery, which has been a recurring theme for them recently, and which doesn't bode well for the relegation fight. And had they got to half time, still level, I think nerves would have crept in even further, and that they may not have ended up winning the match. In fact, they haven't won any match that they've been drawing at half time, which is never a sign of a team with a good mental disposition. But they got a goal just before half time, thanks to a free kick from Diamanti, set up by a brilliant run by Scott Parker, who was the best player on the pitch. He was really excellent. And after that, confidence flowed back into them, and they played very well, and Birmingham really didn't offer anything much. But that will be their home form, and matches like this will be what determines where they finish this season, because they've got 6 away matches left, and they're against the big four, Everton and Fulham, which are all tough away trips, and you wouldn't expect them to get much from that. Mm. But their 7 remaining home games are all against teams who are down there around them.
Extraordinary.
So it's going to be on a knife edge for the rest of the season.
Well, we'll be talking a little bit about Spurs and Man City and all sorts of things, and of course Portsmouth later on. But right now, that's where we'll take a quick musical sting and return with Sid Lowe.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Hello.
Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, could you give me literally about 30 seconds?
Yeah, sure, what are you doing?
I'm just at the bank, I should be out in a second. He's just printing out the form for now.
All right.
Venga, muchas gracias. Ah, te lo firmo, vale. Venga, gracias, hasta luego. Right, so long as this door opens now, I should be fine. Hello.
Sid, where are you?
I'm in a bank.
In a bank, all right then.
Did we catch you mid-robbery?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was just getting the gun out when you phoned. It's ruined everything. The getaway car's got its motor running and everything.
Right, but you're not driving, are you, Sid?
No, I'm in the van. I'm doing the pick-up.
Because that would be illegal.
Obviously, while I'm phoning. Yeah. Whereas I think there's no rules against doing stick-ups while on the phone, is there?
No, as far as I know.
Oof.
A loophole that's yet to be closed,
Sid. A loophole that I think I may have to take advantage of.
Excellent. Speaking of taking advantage, etc., and all that, Seville are through to the final of the Copa del Rey after beating Getafe. Do we want to talk about this, the final of the Copa del Rey?
Well, I think we do in a way.
Do we?
Because there's a series. I don't know how much this interests you in England, but Seville got absolutely battered by Getafe last night. Lost 1-0, but went through 2-1 on aggregate. And I just think, in very, very briefly, there's a problem with the Copa del Rey, because this final is going to be between Atletico Madrid, who might have played 30 or 40 minutes of decent football in the whole tournament, have played a whole load of second division teams and then played Racing Santander, and Sevilla, who've been beaten in every round for the 3 rounds, which is the only 3 rounds that count, because the previous round was against Atletico Ciudad, which are, a team from down in Murcia. or somewhere like that anyway. And we've got two teams who got to the final have done very little to deserve it, in truth.
Atletico are taking on Barcelona this weekend.
Yeah, well, first tonight they play the second leg of the semi-final of the Copa del Rey. The reason I say they're in the final is because they're already 4-0 up, and it would obviously be a miracle if they get knocked out now. They play Barcelona the weekend, and this is huge because, well, it's huge for a number of reasons. The first one, obviously, is that Barcelona haven't been beaten yet this season. They haven't even been behind yet this season. And there's a feeling that this is the game where they might finally drop some points because traditionally, away at the Vicente Calderon, while they have battered Atletico on a number of occasions, they've also been beaten by them. They were beaten by them last year, for example, and briefly that looked like it was going to open up the title race. Of course, you've got that kind of weird situation where all the Real Madrid fans are now claiming to be Atletico Madrid fans for this weekend only. And also because Barcelona go there with virtually no defence because everybody, it seems, is either injured or suspended.
Wow. Barcelona, of course, 5 points clear of Real Madrid, who have Cristiano Ronaldo back in the side for their game at Jerez. A couple of the interesting transfer stories, Sid. One, you mentioned Dani Alves there. I see him being linked with clubs all over the place.
Yeah, I've just dismissed that completely.
All right.
Utter rubbish.
Utter rubbish. Okay, and what about this fresh young story about Cesc Fabregas?
Yes, the story that we hadn't ever heard anywhere before. Yeah, I'm a little bit more suspicious about this one, I have to say. Barcelona have come out and said on their website that there is no deal with Fabregas, there's no negotiation with Fabregas, and their relationship with Arsenal is good.
The rumour is that there is actually a contract that's already been signed.
That's certainly what the rumours are saying, Arsenal have obviously said that they're annoyed that Barcelona won't leave Fabregas alone, and I think this is one of the reasons why Barcelona were stung into action to some extent, because they don't want to be seen as the bad guys in all this. Partly, I think, because Barcelona quite enjoy the notion internationally that Real Madrid are the bad guys. And, of course, Barcelona play on that to some extent. There's also the fact that Fabregas' agent has come out and said that this isn't true. However, it is interesting that this story should break almost simultaneously in three or four different media outlets in Spain. I must admit that I think there's a number of options. The first one, and quite a likely one, I suppose, is that this is really just the follow-up, if you like, to some quotes from Fabregas where, yet again, he said, well, of course one day I'd like to go to Barcelona, which he said millions of times before, and everybody ran with that. I also think, though, that there may well be some ever so slightly deliberate political leaking going on from Joan Laporta, the of course, outgoing Barcelona president. And it is suspicious, this, but right now I don't think there's anything actually done.
Sid, is this not sort of identical to the situation with Ronaldo going to Madrid last season, where it turned out there was, in fact, a contract?
Yeah, absolutely, and this is why I say I'm suspicious rather than dismissing it out of hand. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there was something in place. I think right now there probably isn't anything concrete, but I also think it would be naive of us to assume that there's never been any discussions between Fabregas' camp and Barcelona, even if only in an informal sense. Also, think, bear in mind that underneath all of this, lurking in the Barcelona subconscious must be a sense of, hang on a minute, why should we treat Arsenal nicely over Fabregas when they took him off us in the first place?
Just it reminds me of a few months ago when the same story was doing the rounds of Fabregas being linked to Barcelona, and Arsene Wenger said, yes, it's inevitable that Fabregas will one day go back to Barcelona, as it is with all foreigners, that they eventually want to go home. And he said, that's why I always prefer to sign English players.
I don't necessarily think there's inevitability about him going home, although we saw that in the case of Xavi Alonso and Pepe Reina and Albert Riera both saying that, yeah, it's inevitable that Xavi should want to go back to Spain. So I suspect that in the long run, maybe not this summer, but certainly in the long run, Arsenal are fighting a losing battle.
Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but one day
but
soon
one day,
and for the rest,
and for the rest of
his life.
Yeah.
All right then. Sid, thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
All right then. Excellent. Foreign news, Paul Doyle, Ligue 1.
Yeah, not that much to report.
Right.
I guess it's been Cup Week in France, and I guess the most notable thing is that a team called Queville, an amateur side, have made it all the way through to the quarterfinals. En route, they've beaten three top-flight teams without conceding a goal.
Wow.
And the other thing, of course, is that Bordeaux were knocked out of the Cup this week,
which
follows a league defeat at the weekend. So they're stuttering at the moment. They're still 3 points clear to top, ahead of Montpellier, who haven't dropped away yet.
Newly promoted Montpellier.
Yeah, they're still hanging in there.
Yeah, is this because Laurent Blanc is increasingly being touted for the France job?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe it is, but I don't think so. They're not playing particularly well over the last four games. Actually, they've only won one. And they did have serious designs on winning the cup. It wasn't a case of them fielding a weakened side, because they had they were talking about trying to do the treble this season. Mm. They were missing a couple of players through suspensions, and all their strongest, most physical players, so they were a little bit lightweight when Monaco knocked them out 2-0. Rennes beat them 4-2 at the weekend, and what was most notable about that was that they deliberately tried to exploit their fullbacks. They identified that as a vulnerability, and they man-marked Gourcuff, which teams have tried to do before. But Ren did it successfully.
Right.
That's about it, really.
Oh, right then. Okay, speaking of people wearing football jerseys in France, Barry, I know you were moved to comment about Kasabian and sportswear company's decision to unveil New England shirt in Paris at a rock concert.
Well, the England away shirt, the New England away shirt, was launched at a Kasabian gig in the Olympia in Paris. The other night, the band went off at the end of the gig, went to the dressing room where Tom Kasabian, the lead singer, put on the England away shirt, came back out on stage, gave it the full arms held up messianic crucifixion pose.
Because the French were booing him.
And then the French started booing.
Yeah.
And then they did their encore, yes. I'm on fire. Or fire, whatever it's called.
Right.
So, yeah, it was an interesting choice, getting the sort of a swaggering, pixie boot-wearing, tight-trousered prog rock band from Leicester to launch the shirt, particularly as Tom Kasabian has told The Guardian in the past that he's actually a Republic of Ireland supporter.
Right.
He said
that was before he saw this shirt, though.
Well, it was obviously... Well, the shirt, it has articulated sleeves.
Yes.
So that may
like
have...
Like most shirts. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm struggling to... I presume it's like an articulated lorry in that the sleeve can be moved from side to side, like the trailer of a...
How would that work?
Yeah, I don't know, as opposed to all these very rigid sleeves that most other shirts have that you can't move. But, yeah.
Fabregas has got one of those, I think, last night. Anyway, well, there you go. There's an excellent blog on this. There's an excellent article by young Marina Hyde on this very issue.
Yes, and a member of staff, a member of the PR team who were behind this ridiculous stunt, has attacked her under the comments section of said blog, which is always a foolhardy move. Mm.
You say ridiculous stunt, although I don't know if we'd all have been commenting on the new away strip had it just been unveiled by, well, I was going to say John Terry, I think in that case we would, but by an England face at Wembley. Interesting.
But some other commenter under Marina's blog made the very interesting point that Kasabian were an ideal choice because they're, like England, the England team, really arrogant, nowhere near as good as they think they are, and sort of plodding outfit whose performances away from home often leave a lot to be desired.
Wow, very nice.
Do you think it's something that could catch on for other countries? So, they'd have Franz Ferdinand doing Scotland and the Super Furry Animals doing Wales.
Or right.
Kraftwerk doing Germany's.
That's nice. A Kraftwerk with Germany, that'd be quality, actually.
You'd buy that one, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, if Kraftwerk, Ramazzotti doing Italy.
If Kraftwerk came to Wembley Arena and launched the new Germany away shirt during their encore, that would probably not go down too well.
Well, I'd know, but that'd still be... That has a certain panache to it, doesn't it? Whereas Kasabian in an England...
Kasabian, for me, they kind of sum up... They're the musical equivalent to Soccer AM,
right?
A show they've regularly appeared on wearing their Leicester shirts. And their,
more international news. Panel in Israel, examining Israel's chances of making it to a major tournament, decided that they would sift through all the major international players, managerially speaking, and find a new person to take over the national team. And they settled on Hassan Shahata, who, of course, has had such enormous success with Egypt. Shahata's reaction, I quote, "All my life I've heard that Israel kills our sons and our womenfolk. The first time that I hear they play football too. I would rather die of hunger than manage Israel."
Maybe they should get him. Maybe, it sounds like to me. They should get him to launch their away shirt with the articulated sleeves.
Indeed. So. Now, quick mention of Italy, since we're on an international thing. He's shuffling his papers around. We had our 14th managerial change of the season. It's a lot, isn't it? After Davide Ballardini got the axe from Lazio, as we predicted on Monday that he would, amid shocking scenes at Lazio's training ground at Formello. Basically, you'll recall that they lost at home to relegation strugglers Catania on the weekend. Tuesday, then, around 1,000 fans turned up at training. and managed to force their way in through the gates. They broke the gates open and tried to get to the pitch where the team was certainly going to be going through their paces. But Lazio had come prepared. They had riot police inside and outside the training centre who managed to batter the, using tear gas, etc., managed to push the fans back. There were all sorts of arrests and injuries, etc. Some rocks were thrown, flares, all the usual fun and games. Ballardini was still there because nobody had officially told him he was gone at this point. So he was there kind of watching all this happen. The players didn't manage to do any training. And the day basically finished up with Eddie Reicher, who got axed by Napoli last season after leading them up from the lower divisions, as the new manager. And he's been told that he will be allowed to have the player whose absence Lazio fans have been complaining about, Christian Ledesma, the Argentine midfielder, who was one of the contract rebels who the club had decided so disastrously to freeze out. John Ashdown.
I was just going to ask, do the media in Italy, when something like that happens, because it's just, I sort of sat here thinking, oh, that sounds like the sort of thing that would happen over there. Do the media go? Because if it happened here,
yeah,
people would just go absolutely insane about it. Days and days. But is it just sort of
Lazio knew it was going to happen, and it happens. It happens quite regularly. It was interesting because this ties in with Fabio Capello's remarks, which you probably saw reported about fan power and the ultras and how they are one of the problems crippling, I think was the word he used, Italian football. And he certainly will have experienced this down at Roma, where a lost derby can involve the training ground being sieged, or besieged rather, by irate fans who will then throw fish and wave mops at the players. Wave mops means you should go and clear up. Either that or it's crying out for a return to the sweeper system.
Why do they throw fish?
The fish, I think that's just a,
Doesn't that mean that Luca Bracchi sleeps with
Yeah, it's a Luca Bracchi. No, it's not actually, although, it sounds like it should be. But it's just it's a pejorative action, really. It's just to express their, it can't be pleasant having a fish thrown at you. I'm thinking that would butt my ideas up were I an underperforming player.
I don't think I've ever had a fish thrown at me. No, I've had many things thrown at me. Not a fish.
On the subject of all this, Happy Goth was saying, to what extent do we agree with Capello's analysis that Serie A's fading star is fan problems? Yeah. And also what marketing men would undoubtedly call an inferior consumer experience, the stadiums, basically. I completely agree, and I think the stadiums are if there's one factor in Italy's current malaise, then it is the stadiums. So the good news there is that the Italians, in preparation for their bid for the European Championships in 2016, I have just put through a big law which is enabling government financing of new stadiums, and there should hopefully be a new crop of stadiums in Serie A. More posts coming up right after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Right, well, what I love about the post is you learn lots. For example, we were talking about Gary Cahill and his blood clot. Mm. Barry, you and I both expressed the opinion that surely wasn't that serious that you'd want to miss a season over it. Mark Barsum disagrees, and he's a doctor. He says
he's a doctor.
Right, okay. Well, he sounds it. He says technically it's very rare for someone to have a blood clot in their arm. The reason Gary Cahill can't play is because when anybody suffers a clot, they need treatment which involves thinning the blood with warfarin or heparin to reduce the risk of further blood clots in the lungs. The treatment, which is necessary, means that if anyone hits them, because they've got thin blood, or engages hard, I don't know what that means, would lead to a possible bleed, and therefore they may die. I have to say he's got awful writing, so
he probably is a doctor.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Wango Kid. I can understand you want to talk all about the big four after the midweek results, but I deplore you, he says.
Implore?
That's the one. Devote some time to Spurs and our current woeful predicament. We have a tactically inept manager who's in the dock tomorrow. He is, isn't he, Harry Redknapp, for what is it for? Legally, we need to get the charge right. It's about
Tax evasion.
Right back on us.
No, it's very mysterious. Wango Kid says, I'm fed up with all this in red nap we trust nonsense among fans. We failed to score in 9 Premier League games this season. We've only won one Premier League game in 2010, and we look just awful. Corleone, on a similar theme, says Spurs have spent $79 million on 12 players in a year and a half since Redknapp took over. All he's done is turn them into a slightly better version of Pompey.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Spurs and Villa both have won 2 out of their last 8 games, which is poor by pretty much any standards. They both are being touted as possible, or they were up until recently, were being touted as potential Champions League qualifiers. But the fact of the matter is they're both worse than Liverpool, who are supposedly in crisis.
Mm.
And so it's the same old, same old. I'm not at all surprised Spurs have fallen away from the top four and fully expect them to finish in the usual sort of 8th, 9th, 10th position.
Defeat to Wolves midweek, which is what's prompted some of this posting. But why is it that they have fallen away so badly?
Well, I think Aaron Lennon has been a big miss for them. Also, the Defoe-Crouch partnership front isn't as prolific as Redknapp certainly expected, which raises again the question of why won't he place more trust in Pavlyuchenko, who, whenever I've seen him, he's looked very good. And he's supposed to be the master motivator, but it's only with his pets, it seems.
Well, Spurs are going to be at Bolton in round five of the FA Cup this Sunday. Well, moving on to the FA Cup, and of course, Saturday's games feature that monster South Coast derby, Southampton against Portsmouth, in what could be Pompey's last game ever. You've no doubt seen the news. They've been given 7 days to prove their sustainability. After that, they could be wound up, in a legal sense, and cease to be a footballing entity. My word, although they'll probably just go into administration before that and get a 10-point deduction because they're probably going down anyway. My word, Portsmouth, how do you see this game going? The Scummers against the Skates. Paul, why are they called the Skates?
Yeah, they're both maritime references, scum being the substance that floats on the top of the water. And skate, which is what Southampton fans refer to Pompey fans as, skate is a fish that has an unusually large mouth, and seamen who are at sea for long periods apparently turn to these skates for succor, so to speak.
What a nice meal of skate would kind of remind them of home.
Yeah. Skate and chips.
Right, okay, well, there you go. That's a lovely story. I don't know what the problem with that was.
Look out for stuffed skate on the main.
Yeah. So anyway, well, there you go. Saints have a terrific record against Pompey. Of course, Southampton have been through all this, administration misery themselves and have come out beaming. So perhaps there is a bright future ahead.
Well, there is a bright future ahead for Southampton. They're one of the richest clubs around at the moment, with Marcus Liebherr, this reclusive gazillionaire who's in charge of them. And they've made a lot of judicious signings so far. And they're through to a Wembley final already, of course, because they beat
Johnston Paints.
Yeah, they beat MK Dons during the week.
Yep.
So so they will go into the match with no pressure. They'll go with there's almost their second choice defence, because Alan Pardew bought an entirely new defence in January, but they're all cup tied, so he plays them in the league and he plays the older guys
in the
cup. Yeah. And but they did well. They knocked out Ipswich in the previous round. They were very solid in that, and they deservedly did so. And up front, they've got Ricky Lambert, who's been a tremendous signing for them. He scores non-stop, and now with Lee Barnard beside them. So it's a tough game for Portsmouth, and the atmosphere will be absolutely incredible. I know Southampton have various schemes planned to mock their rivals.
Tell us some
misery. Well, no, nothing particularly original or interesting. Just waving Monopoly money and wearing Sheikh's headgear and sort of stuff. And but yeah.
All right. Well,
I think Southampton's fans would actually miss Portsmouth if they were gone. Because a local rivalry like that is good to have.
Mm.
Despite the fact that they claim to hate each other, I think both would miss the other.
It's a thin line, isn't it?
Yeah.
For example, next week when I'm not here, Barry.
Well, I'm not here either.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Coincidence?
If Portsmouth do go. Portsmouth do go, I know obviously the Premier League want them to struggle through until the end of the season. But if they do go, it would be interesting to see how they're replaced.
Okay, so the mechanism is that in a week's time, when they've had their 7 days to prove that they do have something worth hanging on for, and then the court's given 2 days to look through that document, and then the winding up case is heard. So they either at that point get the locks put on the gates and the lights switched off, or at any point up to that final hearing, they can just say, oh, we're going into administration and you can't touch us. That's how it works, is it?
As far as I know, yeah. But if they do go into administration, my understanding, which isn't very in-depth, but is that the administrator's job is to generate as much money as quickly as possible from the resources at their disposal. So cancel some of the players' contracts, presumably, because they can't continue paying the players' wages. Oh, I assumed that's been the problem. No,
yeah, I assumed it meant they would just see their way through to the end of the
season. Well, that's what the football authorities would like, but that may not be what the administrator.
So we might actually end the season with 19 teams in the Premier League.
But yeah, possibly. And if they do cancel the players, then it could affect the relegation struggle, and because people will be able to, although the transfer window is closed, you can get free agents and sign them. So people may be able to pick up the likes of Nadir Belhaj or Boateng and people like
it
that.
It sounds the stuff of science fiction, and yet it could be happening.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, if, say, worst case scenario, they went out of existence,
yeah,
then all the, I know in the Premier League anyway, all their results would be null and void, which means the table would change considerably in shape. Like, say, Liverpool might go up a place, Arsenal might go down a place, stuff like the relegation battle could end up, do you relegate three teams and bring up four, or do you just relegate two and bring up three?
I think the remaining place should become a wildcard place, and every year you just put all the names of every FA registered club into a hat. And they get drawn. It could be Newcastle United, it could be Dover Athletic, whoever. And they can play one season in the Premier League.
Right.
It's up to them. They get the TV money and everything. Mm-hmm. It's up to them whether they just divvy it up amongst the lads or try and buy players and make a go at a season.
Right.
And at the end of the season, they're back to where they came from.
I know they listen at the Premier League.
Giving the Premier League back to the people.
Yeah, no, the Premier League actually do tune into this show because they've been posting, and Tim Vine there was posting about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which he's giving a big thumbs up. He says he watched it the other day and it's still really good. Just on the subject of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, somebody, and I can't believe I didn't write the name down, posted him with a brilliant link to someone who spent a lot of time putting together the theory on how a Ferris Bueller's Day Off is like a very, very early proto version of Fight Club, wherein the Brad Pitt and Ed Norton roles are actually a reprise of Cameron and Ferris Bueller, and Ferris Bueller is just a figment of Cameron's imagination. It's brilliant stuff. And anyway, sorry, we were talking about the football.
Just to slightly change the subject, a touch. One team, Portsmouth, as you say, are probably not going to go out of business. But one team that probably are Chester City in the Blue Square Premier, who failed to fulfil their fixture on Tuesday because of failing to play the players for 3 months, basically, and aren't able to play their fixture against Wrexham on the weekend because they can't afford to pay the police, who they also owe for months and months. So there's a meeting today that is likely to boot them out of the league.
Wow. So what will happen in that case to the results so far?
Well, all the results will be null and void. But because they have been fairly useless anyway, it's not going to make a huge change to the table because most teams have beaten them throughout the season. But I think it might change the leaders. I think Stevenage and Oxford might swap places.
Right. Okay. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, there you go. Now, in other FA Cup games this weekend, Chelsea are taking on Cardiff, who also were in the winding up, tax or bankruptcy, whatever, court. They got a month to sort their affairs out, or at least to prove that they are a viable concern, whereas Portsmouth only got a week. A lot of people pointing to that as significant. Southend were also in there as well.
Well, being in the mire seems to sort of give you a good chance of stringing a decent cup run together, because in this round you've got Notts County are there, Southampton, Portsmouth, Crystal Palace, Cardiff City, all the clubs that are deep in the financial doo-doo.
Mm. Crystal Palace, of course, hosting Aston Villa. And how are they doing, Palace? We mentioned the fact they'd won both of their games since they got the 10-point penalty.
They lost at home to Swansea in the week.
Right.
Shefki Kuki scoring the goal. It should be a really good game, actually. I think Neil Warnock, when he gets his teams in sort of cup mode, they can be quite a formidable opposition, and they'll fancy their chances, I think, particularly at home.
Right, OK. And Palace, being 1 point off relegation, will perhaps have their minds elsewhere. Fulham taking on Notts County, you mentioned. Fulham had a big win against Burnley midweek. Chelsea, as I say, taking on Cardiff without John Terry. Derby against Birmingham. Man City against Stoke.
Sorry, you're about to skip past Derby, Birmingham.
Oh, right.
There. I just think that's a potential upset. I think Derby will win that game.
All right. Okay, and Man City taking on Stoke. David Wheater's chin, a question for Sean or anyone else. What are the odds Adam Johnson gets in the England World Cup squad instead of Stuart Downing? Johnson has all the trademarks of Downing combined with more speed and skill. Fair shout?
I think they're very similar. Very similar levels of players. I've always rated Johnson. I think whenever I've seen him on loan for lower league clubs, he's looked really, really good. But The caveat is he is obviously playing at a slightly lower level, and this will be the first, if he does indeed get a run in the City team.
Well, he played for them against, Bolton?
Bolton was good.
Won the penalty, didn't he? But if he does, you know, he'll need to have any chance of getting in the World Cup squad, he'll need to play consistently between now and the end of the season. And if he does, yeah, he's got a shout.
Very, very good. And Reading West Brom completes the fifth round fixture programme. Excellent. Enjoy all of that this weekend. And enjoy Paul McInnes when he arrives on Monday to captain Football Weekly's roundup of it all. He'll be there on Thursday as well for Football Weekly Extra while I am off on hold. Many thanks in the meantime, Paul Dore, for joining us.
Yep, bye.
And John Ashdown.
Cheers.
And Barry, who's got to run off now and write the fiver.
Yes.
Is he going to be particularly funny and crackling with wit today, Barry?
No, it isn't.
Wow. Come. Anyway, it'll be up at 5 o'clock about the time this podcast is.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice one. All right, lovely. Thanks, everybody. Speak to you in a week and enjoy in the meantime.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.